If you're an establishment Republican who wants to regain control of the GOP from the Tea Party, last night was a good night. This hour, analysis of election results across the country and here in Iowa. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, our analysts, Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, will give us their thoughts on yesterday's election, including why the Koch brothers poured some $30 million into a campaign to defeat incumbents on Coralville's city council. We'll also ask about the significance of Chris Christie's easy win in New Jersey and Democrat Terry McAuliffe's narrow win over Republican Ken Cuccinelli in the Virginia gubernatorial race. Politics Day starts after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday has arrived once again. Yesterday, an off-year election. I guess that's what's being said about it. Our analyst today, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, where he is Associate Professor of Political Science. Also, Chris Larimer, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa, joining us in our Cedar Falls studio. Chris Larimer, Tim Hagel, welcome.
Thank you.
We want to take a look initially at a number of interesting municipal elections in the state, some things put to the voters in a couple of different areas, and then turn to those bellwether races that have been reported on in on NPR over the last few weeks. So let's start with a very interesting race in Coralville, Iowa. Iowa Public Radio's Dean Borg is in our Iowa City studio. Dean, hi.
Good morning.
Tell us, what was so notable about the city council election in Coralville?
Well, you have to know a little bit about the history of what's been happening there. They have been very aggressive in Coralville about economic development, and they have used what's called TIF, tax increment financing, to do a lot of that. And it is heavily leveraged Coralville in its debt, and Moody's Financial has downgraded Coralville accordingly to a B rating, whereas Cedar Rapids and Ames have AAA ratings, West Des Moines in that category too. So you see Coralville, and I talked with the city manager a month or so ago, and he said, yeah, we're trying to change that. We think that, you know, we're better off than that. But that also made some business owners in Coralville angry, because the city was, they said, bringing in competition for existing business owners. Mm-hmm. And they even filed a court suit on that. So you see, that was the unrest that fueled eight people running for three city council seats and four mayoral candidates.
Not only that, but we had a lot of outside money coming from Americans for Prosperity. This is which group? This is the Koch brothers.
$30 million fueling. In fact, I talked to John Lundell in his home this morning.
The new mayor.
He said, did you see any of this? And he hauled out a handful of direct mail campaign literature, and there were newspaper ads too, very, very negative, alleging special perks for the incumbents, such as property tax assessments being lowered, and also bringing to citizens' attention the city's financial status and debt, which I have described to you.
Mm-hmm. Now, we want to ask our analysts in just a moment about the views of this outside money involved in this race, but also unique about this is that the new mayor, Lundell, received a surprise call last night, didn't he?
Well, he did, and I talked with him about that, and he told me that it was a very big surprise.
It certainly was unexpected. We were at the celebratory event last night, and about 9 o'clock, my phone rang, and it was a 202 area code, which I know is D.C., and it kind of struck me as odd that someone was calling me from D.C., so I answered a phone. He says, John, this is Vice President Joe Biden, and he has such a distinctive voice, I could tell it wasn't a prank. And he just said that he wanted to call and congratulate me, and especially congratulate the residents of Coralville on the overwhelming victory against the Koch brothers. You know, it kind of took my breath away at first, but, you know, I thanked them and really, you know, said how proud I was of our community that we stood up against this type of outside influence. And that's what he said, that, you know, it has no place in politics at any level, at least alone at the local level like Coralville.
Coralville's new mayor, John Lundell, in conversation with Iowa Public Radio's Dean Borg. This is so unusual. The Vice President of the United States calling to congratulate on a council election, a city council election in Coralville.
And I would be interested in what your political analysts have to say in the subsequent conversation here. But Biden went on to say that he has been put in charge of relations with municipalities across the country, and he urged Lundell to stay in touch with him. And John jokingly said, yeah, next time in Washington, I'm going to knock on his door.
All right. Iowa Public Radio's Dean Borg, thank you very much for bringing us up to date on that. We'll let you get back to a feature that you'll be preparing for this afternoon for the newscast coming up. Just a minute. Chris Larimer and Tim Hagel, let's get analysis on this from you. Chris Larimer, start us off.
Well, yeah, I was wondering, before Dean leaves, wanted to mention that Buck Clark, who was reelected mayor of Waterloo, also received a call from Vice President
Buck Joe Clark Butt. Of Waterloo, yeah. Mayor of Waterloo, got a call from Vice President as well.
Oh, yes. That's a surprise to me, yes.
Yeah. So, you know, it's hard to know what to make of it.
What's the significance of that, you think, in Waterloo?
I'm not sure. You know, if he's trying to, if there are political implications for 2016.
Because this is Iowa. That's
right,
it, right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, that would seem to be the obvious answer.
Yep.
But it still seems a bit odd to me.
Connect with the grassroots.
Yeah,
all right.
Exactly.
Okay, once again, thanks, Dean Borg. So tell us a little bit more. Tim Hagel, what are the views of this outside money involved in this race? Can you figure out why the Koch brothers, the Americans for Prosperity, would pour $30 million into a campaign to defeat incumbents? It was unsuccessful.
Right. Let me actually circle around a little bit to that and kind of go back to the earlier one just quickly. One of the reasons why the vice president might have called, at least here in Coralville, the successful person was because of the Koch brothers being such a, you know, on the other side of these issues, and it's a high profile kind of thing, and of course made the Coralville race high profile. So it's not entirely surprising. And of course, as Chris was sort of hinting at, that the idea that calling a couple of mayors victorious in Iowa, maybe looking towards 2016. And, you know, people are still thinking, well, probably if Hillary's going to jump in and is that going to clear the field? Well, you know, maybe Joe Biden says, hey, I'm not out of it yet. And he may be still thinking about himself. As far as the outside money, it is kind of surprising where you see a group that in a municipal election like that drops a lot of money. And a number of people have been asking, well, the why part of this, why would you invest so heavily? Well, if a particular group, whether it's Americans for Prosperity or some other group, thinks that there's some big issue or important issue that they want to highlight, and it happens to be in a municipal election, this may be the way to go. And of course, for Americans for Prosperity, the debt and the deficit, and if they're picking a particular town that says, look, this is this town that's sort of on the road to ruin, as they undoubtedly characterized it, that we, you know, have to be responsible and make sure that we're having responsible people that are in office. It also is a situation where they could have been experimenting with ways of reaching the voters, that sort of a trial run, so to speak, for either 2014 or what they might be planning for 2016.
Mm-hmm. Anything to add to that, Chris?
Well, I think, you know, the outside money is unique because this is a nonpartisan – these are nonpartisan races, right? These are supposed to be issues where there is not a Republican or Democratic side to necessarily spending. I think what Tim is saying is right. I think you're looking at maybe the Koch brothers testing out or a way to assess the strength of this issue of government spending and government debt. You know, is this something that has staying power that the group will be able to use in the 2014 elections?
Okay. Join our conversation. We're just starting to look at the election results, to draw some analysis from them. How are you interpreting the election results yesterday? 1-866-780-9100 here in Iowa or beyond. And let's turn to from Coralville to a neighboring Iowa City. Iowa City voters upheld a 21 ordinance in last night's election. The ordinance prohibits anyone from under the age of 21 from being in a bar after 10 p.m., some exceptions for venues like music venues. This is the second time that opponents have tried to overturn the measure. Shortly after its passage in 2010, a petition drive forced a vote, and the ordinance was upheld by 52% of the voters. Last night, 66% of voters supported the ordinance. Iowa City Mayor Matt Hayek says success was due to several factors.
As in 2010, we did a great job, I think, of reaching out to the voters, getting the message out there, and interfacing with people that we believed would vote in this election. That made a huge difference. I think it also helped that many of the people who were opposed to 21 or reluctant about 21 3 years ago came around over the last 3 years. And then lastly, I would say that the pro-repeal group focused, from my perspective, entirely on campus and did not appear to engage in any effort to communicate with the voters out in the community. No yard signs, no mailings, et cetera. It was an entirely campus-focused effort, and I think that may explain part of it.
Okay. Iowa City Mayor Matt Hayek. Tim Hagel, so we have opponents of the measure relying on what we know has traditionally been an unreliable electorate, the young voters trying to overturn it. Your analysis on this strategy?
Yeah, I suppose of the mayor's 3 points, I would agree most with the last one in terms of the approach. And you're right that normally when you look at various age groups, that the youngest age group, 18 to 24 is how it's usually pegged, has normally the lowest turnout. That's not true in this college town, at least. I haven't checked over in Ames and elsewhere. But at least here in Iowa City, because of the student groups on campus, whether it's the University Democrats or the College Republicans or in a nonpartisan situation like this just in general, that they usually do pretty well, and it's the next highest group that has the lower turnout. Mm-hmm. But this time, you have turnout among the students. And so this time around, the students that are on campus, they've never experienced, as one person put it, the bar scene in Iowa City beyond 10 p.m. And so they don't have that feeling of loss in that sense. And so they weren't as excited about turning out. And although the students that were trying to get people to turn out, perhaps I don't say that they made a wrong decision focusing only on campus. It's just that they weren't as successful in getting that vote to turn out.
Chris Lehrman, talk about voter turnout in this election, perhaps in this case, but also what you saw as interesting across the state.
Well, I think, I've focused a lot on the turnout numbers in Waterloo and Cedar Falls up here, but generally they're aligned with the last three elections where you're talking about maybe 18 to 20% turnout of registered voters. And I think, my guess is that will be fairly typical across the state. And, for some people that may be a concern where you're talking about 20% of the electorate showing up on election day. On the other hand, there's some work in political science that suggests this is actually a very informed electorate that's showing up. You know, we always complain about uninformed voters. Chances are the folks that are showing up that were showing up yesterday were very informed. You know, usually the research shows that these are longtime residents of the city. They have a deep concern for the city. They're homeowners. And so they know a lot about the issues. And these oftentimes are issue voters. You know, in state elections and particularly national elections, we see a lot of voters who turn out. They're excited about a candidate. They're excited about their party. They may not know a lot about the issues. Chances are that the folks that showed up yesterday were maybe more informed than we might see come next November.
So when we have non-off-year elections, what you're saying is we have perhaps less informed people who make a vote based on a 30-second commercial, maybe.
Right, yeah. So we may have fewer voters yesterday, but they may be more informed than the ones that that would show up next year or in 2016.
Would you agree with that, Tim Hagel?
Oh, yeah, that's true. And that's often, as Chris was saying, a concern that you have people that are making their decisions based on, as you said, a 30-second commercial or some impression. And that's why it's always incumbent on the opposition, regardless of which side the opposition is, to counter any negative ads, to help explain why we talk about defining candidates and why those definitions can become harmful if they are negative and made early. And so you tend to not have that quite as much as Chris was saying in an election like this where the voters that do actually turn out tend to be more informed.
Within the borders of Iowa, let's instance that is of interest to us for these purposes. Polk County, a bond issue there. Iowa Public Radio's Rob Dillard joins us. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Ben.
What were the voters being asked in this bond issue?
Well, it's actually the second time they've been asked in the last 5 years to approve a bond issue to improve and expand the court system in Polk County. And if anyone has been in the 106-year-old Polk County Courthouse, they will know why this bond issue keeps coming up. This time, voters approved It was an $81 million bond issue. 67% of Polk County voters said yes to it. It will allow some renovations of the old courthouse. It will take the old jail in downtown Des Moines and renovate it into some court space. And it will also take a building that once houses a JCPenney store and convert that into some more court annexes. So this time around, $81 million bond issue approved. 5 years ago, 2008, a $132 million bond issue was voted down.
So that's somewhat similar issue, certainly a difference in the amount of the bond issue. But any talk of what this indicates about the electorate?
I think supporters made a stronger case this time. They really emphasized the need from a safety and security point of view, and made it very clear that the court system here needed to expand, needed better space, needed better security measures.
Mm. I see outside spending in the at-large Des Moines City Council race as well.
That was an interesting race, yes. The outside group, National Association of Realtors Fund, gave $57,000 to one of the at-large people. Chris Diebel was running for that spot against an incumbent, Skip Moore. Now, we don't have Democratic-Republican race in city council races in Des Moines, but both of these gentlemen are Democrats. Chris Diebel was hurt by this incoming money. A lot of voters thought that wasn't right in a local election. He was also harmed by a late mailing he sent out that attempted to tie Skip Moore to a $40 million franchise fee that a court had ordered Des Moines to pay back. Well, Chris, Skip Moore was not on the council at the time that court order came through. Mm-hmm. And Diebel's attempts to tie Moore to it, I think, turned some voters against him.
Okay. Iowa Public Radio's Rob Dillard. Thank you for getting us up to date on Polk County and Des Moines.
You're welcome.
And it's Politics Day here on River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer. Our analysts, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa, circling back to that outside money. We had to an email from Chris in North Liberty. He writes, he wonders if the AFP money, that was the money from the Koch brothers, hurt the challengers to the Coralville race. These folks were business people, community members too. Their message may have been lost among the AFP money and reputation. Tim Hagel, do you think that's right when you as someone challenging an incumbent have this outside money primarily because it's outside, that it's some could be resented?
Absolutely, and particularly in a municipal election like this, where, as was indicated for Des Moines and perhaps that backlash against Diebel, the idea that, wait a minute, why is some outside group getting involved in our local campaign? We're a little bit more used to it at either a congressional district level or state level or national level, even if some people still don't like it. But when you get down to that local level and it's so unusual, especially in a smaller town, including a small town as Des Moines, which biggest in our state, that people don't like it, they kind of wonder, and it certainly gives the incumbent an opportunity to attack them even though they don't have that money supporting them.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there's some truth to that as well, Chris?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, these are nonpartisan elections. These are supposed to be not Republican or Democratic issues. These are local issues dealing with local spending, property taxes, what have you. And so the idea that an outside group would come in just really politicizes an election that most people see as not – you know, trying to reduce politics.
Mm-hmm. Chris, what do you see as driving turnout in local elections? Is it different than what drives national and state elections?
I do. I think it's what Tim and I were talking about earlier. I think a lot of it is issues, and it's going to depend. It's going to be a city-by-city basis, and I think that's what makes predicting turnout and predicting who people are going to vote for so difficult for political analysts. I mean, it's going to be an issue-by-issue basis. You don't have this overarching issue that carries across every single election in every single city in Iowa. It's going to be they're called local elections for a reason. So, I think predicting turnout is going to be difficult unless you are in that city and know what the major issue is going to be. The other side of it, of course, is that local governments, for the most part, are really hamstrung by what they can do. They have very limited powers in terms of raising revenue. And so, they're nonpartisan elections with city officials who are coming in who really are dependent upon the state government for any sort of power that they have.
Tim Hagel.
Just one quick bit of evidence to support Chris's statement is that here in Johnson County, we had record turnout in some cities, including Coralville, in part perhaps because of the AFP money coming in. And yet in Iowa City, although turnout was more than you might consider the average, it certainly was nowhere near a record. Mm-hmm. So it just depends on the local issues.
Are there some races locally within Iowa that we haven't touched on that you want to either you want to bring up, Chris?
Well, you know, the mayoral election in Waterloo, where Buck Clark got the call from Vice President Biden, that actually came down to, I think the separation right now is 87 votes out of about 9,100. So it's less than 1%. Still unsure whether or not the challenger, Steve Schmidt, in that case, will do a recount or ask for the recount there. Just looking around last night, I noticed at least, I think, 22 incumbent mayors that lost in various small towns around eastern Iowa. A number of female candidates winning city council races, knocking off incumbents. So still trying to tabulate some of the results, but those are at least two of the surprising things I've seen. Mm-hmm.
In that Waterloo election, what were the main things at issue? What was being argued there?
Well, Buck Clark and Steve Schmidt have kind of battled back and forth for a number of years, and it's always come down to budget and property taxes, who's doing the right thing with budget, and who is one side raising or causing property taxes to go up or down. So kind of the perennial issue for local politics, but these are two individuals that have known each other for a long time. Steve Schmidt sits on the Waterloo City Council as an at-large candidate and will continue to do so for two more years. But they battled back in 2009 had a runoff election then. So it's it wasn't surprising that there would be competitive. It just happened that mm-hmm. Mayor Clark was reelected.
You said it's a very very close race, but also mm-hmm. Very low turnout.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean for mayors and councils when they're elected by such small numbers of voters? Anything?
Well, I think it means, it's just important to make that connection with voters. It's a different electorate than you would see that you'll see next November or even in 2016. And so it's important to make that connection with local voters and understand that that there are differences between the candidates. And I think that's difficult for the average voter. Someone who doesn't necessarily always show up for a municipal mm-hmm. election, it's going to be hard for them to see differences between candidates.
Mm-hmm. When you have only, say, 20% of the electorate turning out to vote, though, Tim Hagel, and you get the vote, maybe you get 7 or 8% of that vote, hardly a mandate in any case, even if you win.
You're right, and that's exactly what I was thinking. It's not a mandate. It's hard then to whatever extent a mayor has powers over the city council to actually do anything. But on the other hand, the low turnout suggests a relative amount of satisfaction among the electorate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's key. There's some work that talks about these local elections as sort of what they call, quote, managerial democracies, where, if you have a mayor or a city council member who is part of a city that seems to be doing well, they're managing the city well, maybe low turnout is actually a good sign. Or if they're running unopposed, maybe that's actually a good thing.
Okay, we want to pick up after a short break. We're going to talk about what has been talked about is the bellwether races in the state. I'm sure Tim Hagel and Chris Larimer have plenty to talk about in that. Chris Christie easily reelected in New Jersey as a governor and a Republican there. We'll talk about what that means for the establishment Republican Party, also for the Tea Party wing of the GOP. Also in Virginia, Democrat Terry McAuliffe, a longtime fundraiser for the Clintons, winning barely, though, in a much closer race than was expected. And we'll talk about that in just a moment. I want to remind you that related to probably a lot of our listeners will be interested in tuning into tomorrow's program here on River to River. She was the first woman to serve as Chief Justice of Iowa Supreme Court, but she's perhaps best known as one of the Iowa Supreme Court justices dismissed by Iowa voters 3 years ago for her role in the decision that legalized same-sex marriage in the state. Tomorrow on this program, my conversation with Marcia Ternus, her thoughts on that ruling now 3 years on, and her thoughts on justice and judicial independence in the U.S. tomorrow on this program. When we come back, we'll talk about the significance of the Virginia race, of the race in New Jersey, and get your thoughts as well. What have you drawn out of these election results in this off-year election? 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or tweet us at IPR Talk. Back with more of Politics Wednesday after a short break. Back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News on this Politics Wednesday. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tim Hagel joining us, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Chris Larimer, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. We hope you'll join our conversation. How are you interpreting the election results yesterday? What do you see in those races in Virginia, in New Jersey? We're going to be talking about, and also, of course, all roads lead to 2014, but then even the 2016 as well. So what are your thoughts on the possibility of a Chris Christie, Hillary Clinton race in 2016? 1-866-780-9100, River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Find us on Facebook and leave a comment or tweet us at IPR Talk. Republican Governor Chris Christie elected to a second term by an overwhelming margin, and that in spite of a Democratic voter registration edge in that state, New Jersey. The fact that New Jersey voters left Democrats in control of the state and Senate assembly, and the fact that voters overwhelmingly approved a constitutional amendment that will raise the state's minimum wage from $7.25 to $8.25 per hour. So perhaps it's not surprising that in his victory speech, Chris Christie struck a strongly bipartisan tone.
People of New Jersey 4 years ago were downhearted and dispirited. They didn't believe that government could work for them anymore. In fact, what they thought was that government was just there to take from them, but not to give to them, not to work with them, not to work for them. Well, 4 years later, we stand here tonight showing that it is possible to put doing your job first, to put working together first, to fight for what you believe in, yet still stand by your principles and get something done for the people who elected you. The biggest thing I've learned over the last 4 years about leadership is that leadership is much less about talking than it is about listening, about bringing people around the table, listening to each other, showing them respect, doing what needed to be done to be able to bring people together and to achieve what we needed to achieve to move our state forward. Now listen, I know that if we can do this in Trenton, New Jersey, maybe the folks in Washington, D.C. should tune in their TVs right now, see how it's done.
And that wasn't the only reference that Chris Christie made to dysfunction in government at the national level in his speech.
I know that tonight, a dispirited America, angry with their dysfunctional government in Washington, looks to New Jersey to say, is what I think happening really happening? Are people really coming together? Are we really working African Americans and Hispanics, suburbanites and city dwellers, farmers and teachers? Are we really all working together? Let me give the answer to everyone who is watching tonight. Under this government, our first job is to get the job done, and as long as I'm governor, that job will always, always be finished.
Republican Governor Chris Christie of New Jersey reelected to a second term by overwhelming margins in yesterday's election. Chris Larimer, let me turn to you first of all. Sounding like a presidential kickoff for 2016?
Well, certainly the second clip resonates that way. You know, he's already using the theme of running as a Washington outsider, or at least that's what it's coming off as, the, you know, that Washington is out of touch, but at the state level they've figured it out. So that was kind of interesting. I also think the first clip there where he talked about that, the idea that government could, quote, give, or that government can be giving, is not maybe not necessarily a Republican theme in terms of thinking about government giving over services, but you know, this was a big win. I think most people expected Chris Christie to win pretty easily, and he did. But until the results come in, you know, we weren't sure. And most of the exit polls are showing that he won quite well with a number of different demographic groups. So I think he's going to be very popular. There was an article today in the New York Times talking about he takes over as chair of the Republican Governors Association later this month. So he's going to have a lot of visibility going forward for the next few months, and it'll just be
right. Analysis I heard was that position gives him the excuse to go to any state in the union.
Exactly.
Do you think he'll do that?
Yes, I think he will. There was speculation in that article that he would help out Republican incumbents in South Carolina and Iowa. So, I would not be surprised if he did that at all.
Tim Hagel, your thoughts?
Yeah, I would echo pretty much everything Chris was saying that, this certainly gives Christie a platform, and I know many people have been suggesting that this perhaps gives him the spotlight in terms of a presidential run. On the other hand, other people are saying, well, yes and no, he didn't have that much in way of coattails because he still has to deal with the Democrats in the state legislature. But then, of course, that fits into Christie's notion of bipartisanship. Also, the electorate that comes out in an off-year election is quite different than it would be in a presidential election. And as I had in a conversation I had on Twitter, that his opponent, Buono, was certainly not perhaps Hillary Clinton, if that's the nominee for the Democrats. And so stronger candidate, a national election, maybe not quite the same turnout that you would see in a situation like this. On the other hand, he should come to Iowa and test the waters.
Okay. Let's hear what Sophia thinks in Des Moines. She called 1-866-780-9100. Sophia, hi. Sophie,
hi.
Is it Sophia?
Sophia.
Sophia, very good. I got it right the first time. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I just wanted to say, in regards to Governor Christie, congratulations, first of all. And for full disclosure, I am a very liberal Democrat, African-American, college-educated woman, and I would have voted for Chris Christie in a heartbeat.
Okay, so when we look at what he got, it looks, according to exit polls, impressive scores. Democrats,
yes.
32% of the vote, Latinos, 51%, and even African-Americans, 21%. So what makes him so appealing, you think, to these minority voters?
Well, because let's make no mistake. Christie is a conservative, and there's nothing wrong with that. He is a true conservative. However, he lives in reality. He understands governing, and he picks his battles wisely. He's the likable guy who happens to be a Republican. So for that, he is unique to New Jersey. Unfortunately, I don't think that this will have any implications for the national GOP. They will not look to him as an example. And I think it's sad because, he probably will not be able to survive the wrath of the very exclusive and rabid GOP-based voters in 2016. That's the problem.
Okay.
He's unique to New Jersey.
Let me see if I can ask you, as you describe yourself as a liberal Democrat voter who likes Chris Christie, let me ask you the same exit polling question that was asked of New Jersey voters. Despite Chris Christie's 20-point-plus win, voters by a 48-44% margin said they'd vote for Hillary Clinton over their governor. Now, what if the race was Hillary Clinton and Chris Christie? How would you vote?
At this point, it's too early to say because we still don't know if Hillary Clinton will be the nominee. We still don't know that. I know it's speculation. I will be honest with you. Like I said, as a liberal Democrat, African-American female, I would be torn. But again, that's New Jersey. I don't know. I can't say. But I would at least, I'll put it this way. I would at least give Christie a look.
Very good. Thank you.
I really would. Thank you.
Okay. Sophia, joining us from Des Moines, 1-866-780-9100. Join us with your interpretation of the election results, Chris Christie's win. We want to get on to Virginia in just a moment. So what do you think, Chris Larimer, any further implications beyond New Jersey? Is this the cult of Chris Christie, or does it say something more about the establishment GOP, this type of candidate positioning himself in the GOP spectrum this way? Or is it this personality, Chris Christie, that people find so appealing?
I think right now it's the personality. Without, living in New Jersey, for outsiders, I think right now it's just the personality of someone who seems like he can get something done and is willing to, kind of have that straight talk with voters. What would be interesting is, as Tim alluded to, as we get closer to 2016, if Chris Christie decides to run, if he's able to maintain that perception as sort of above the fray of politics, where he starts to engage in a primary or caucus season where the tendency is to run to the extreme of your party, having to put out negative campaign ads, if that perception starts to go away.
Mm-hmm. Tim Hagel, can you imagine what the scene would be like when and if Chris Christie is involved in the GOP
a primary in Iowa caucuses. How would he fare in Iowa?
Well, you know, I know that a lot of people suggest that he wouldn't do well in Iowa because they have this perception, and I don't think it's entirely true, that the Iowa GOP is dominated by social conservatives. And if although Christie's pro-life, Catholic, and so forth, that he still may not be conservative enough. I'm not sure that's true, and especially to the extent that in the clips that you were playing of him, that he talks about, you know, getting the job done. I think that that would resonate with Iowans all across the board, Democrats and Republicans, sort of that, you know, kind of a hard-nosed, let's get it done kind of a thing. There is that practical aspect to it. On the other hand, conservatives in the state, social conservatives or fiscal conservatives otherwise, on the GOP side, are concerned that, well, we've tried the moderate before. People have said that, yes, we need to have a more moderate candidate to win the general election, and it hasn't happened. They selected Dole, they selected McCain, they selected Romney, and so at this point they're getting pretty tired of it and maybe want to try to have a more conservative, what they feel is more conservative candidate.
Rick is joining us from Iowa City. He dialed 1-866-780-9100. Rick, hi, welcome.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I was wondering, thank you. I was wondering what your panel ideas are on the fact that Christie scheduled Cory Booker's election 2 or 3 weeks before his, and if you think that would have had any difference on the percentage, perhaps, having a high profile Democrat running on the same election cycle and spending $24 million for a new election. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Rick. Cory Booker choosing to and succeeding in capturing the Senate there. Tim Hagel, your thoughts on that question?
Yeah, a lot of people were negative about that decision and suggesting that for political reasons, Christie didn't want to be on the same ballot with Booker. On the other hand, even if they had been on the same ballot, it probably would have affected the results to a certain extent. But we saw a lot of ticket splitting as it was. As already mentioned, that they increased the minimum wage in the state and they returned the Democrats to the state legislature and yet still overwhelmingly went for Christie. My guess is that many of the New Jersey voters would have been perfectly happy to split their vote and vote for Christie for governor and Booker for the Senate.
Yeah, I would agree with him. And I think it goes back to what he said earlier, Christie's challenger was not particularly strong. I'm not sure how excited Democrats were about the challenger in that case compared to the excitement for Booker.
Mm-hmm. In the New Jersey governor race, is there a consensus in the Republican Party, Tim Hagel, you think, about what this means? You're hearing one thing from the Tea Party faction and another thing from the establishment Republican faction.
And that's exactly it, is that your different people are taking away different things from that particular election. It's certainly good that the Governor Christie got a majority of women voters, a majority of Hispanic voters, a better-than-usual percentage of black voters. But on the other hand, does that translate? And that's sort of the other side. And again, the unique circumstances, the weak candidate. So regardless of what you think about the governor, you can probably find something to support your position in that race.
Okay, another one that is open to interpretation, the race in Virginia, much watched there. Democrat Terry McAuliffe, a longtime fundraiser for the Clintons, won his gubernatorial election in Virginia, defeating a social conservative, Virginia Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli. Some Tea Party favorites, like Senators Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, campaigned on Cuccinelli's behalf. Despite this win for Democrat McAuliffe, he now faces the job of leading a state where at least one of the legislative chambers is dominated by Republicans. McAuliffe says he'll follow in the footsteps of Virginian Thomas Jefferson and three of Virginia's recent governors, both Democrat and Republican, to keep his state moving forward.
The truth is that this election was never a choice between Democrats and Republicans. It was a choice about whether Virginia would continue the mainstream bipartisan tradition that has served us so well over the last decade. At a time when Washington was often broken, just think about what Virginia has been able to accomplish when we work together. Under Governor Mark Warner, we preserved our AAA bond rating, and he made the single largest investment in K-12 education in Virginia history. Under Governor Tim Kaine, we were honored as the best state to do business, the best managed state, and he prudently guided us through the Great Recession. And let me say this.
under Governor Bob McDonnell, our unemployment is one of the lowest on the East Coast, and we passed the first transportation funding in 27 years with bipartisan support. Now, during the next 4 years, it will be my obligation and honor to continue that tradition. And to get started, over the next 3 months, I am going to work hard to reach out to every single Republican in the General Assembly. I want to listen to them, and I want to work with them so we can advance our shared goals.
Newly elected Democratic Governor Terry McAuliffe in Virginia. I wonder, Chris, this was closer than expected. I think, what, a three-point separation between them, polls before showing even double digits leads by Terry McAuliffe. What led to this narrowing?
Well, I think that's a good question. I'm not sure if we have an answer to it yet. You know, in some ways, this was almost the first referendum on Tea Party candidates on maybe a little bit bigger scale following the government shutdown, where a lot of people seem to blame folks who affiliated with the Tea Party in government as the reason for the shutdown. So you have a candidate in Ken Cuccinelli who at least have, you know, folks in the United States Senate who are associated with the Tea Party coming out and campaigning on his behalf, which you think would actually hurt him. You have McAuliffe spending close to $15 million more than Cuccinelli in the campaign. And yet, you know, you have a close race. Part of that could be that, you know, and it was said many times leading up to the race that Virginia rarely elects someone who shares the party affiliation of the president in these off-year elections, right? You have to, I think, go back to 1974 for the last time that that happened. So the trend should have been to elect a Republican this time around. I think it was just you had someone in McAuliffe who was a great fundraiser, was able to use that money to his advantage. It was going to be a hard race.
But also timing. I mean, yeah. With the last few weeks, the dominant political story has been the botched rollout of the Affordable Care Act, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think that maybe narrowed the race a bit as well. So I think we're kind of waiting to see what the true story is in Virginia. But I think it's surprising in a number of levels for the amount of money that was spent, for the gap in spending, for the fact that it was supposed to be a bigger victory for McAuliffe, but it wasn't, the fact that a Democrat still won with a Democrat in the White House. So I think there are a number of interesting factors here.
Mm-hmm. Would Tim Hagel, a more moderate Republican, have taken the seat from the Democrats?
Well, it's certainly going to be an argument that some people will make. But I think that, as Chris was laying out a number of the factors, other things that came into play were the fact that the current governor was having some ethical issues, and so he couldn't campaign on behalf of Cuccinelli, and his own popularity declined. Apparently, there were some ethical considerations with Cuccinelli himself towards the end of the campaign. Chris was mentioning the shutdown, and that affected Northern Virginia voters, a lot of federal government workers, and so they were unhappy. So, in that respect, but also the shutdown masked some of the problems that were initially happening with Obamacare when the Affordable Care Act when it came out. And then, of course, once the shutdown was over, then the focus was on that, and that seemed to cause a surge for Cuccinelli. So there are a lot of things going on in this race that I'm not sure what you can take out of it at this point.
We've heard that the Cuccinelli campaign begged Chris Christie to campaign for him in Virginia. He didn't repeatedly turn them down. What do you imagine the problem is there?
Well, it could be a combination of things that some people were saying, oh, well, Christie had his own race to run, but he was pretty secure, so he could have easily gone down to help out a fellow Republican running for a governorship. But it may have been that he wanted to distance himself, that he wanted to basically make sure that his victory, Christie's victory, was a solid enough one that he could use it as a platform for his own perhaps presidential ambitions.
Mm-hmm. Let me read a couple of listener comments that have come in the meantime. I think by the fall of 2016, writes Randy in Iowa City, it will have become obvious that far too much was made of Governor Christie's chances in the presidential race. He might be able to do okay playing at the middle in a general election, but the fact is he'll be eaten alive in the GOP primaries. Christie won't stand a chance outside of his local bubble. That from Randy in Iowa City. Heidi, listening in Johnston, writes, I'm a very moderate Democrat, independent. I would love to vote for Chris Christie for president. He's a Republican who actually speaks kindly and sanely and is not such a hater. The term hater came about as a popular term in the last few years for a reason, and it's
all the venom that spews forth from so many politicians these days, writes Heidi. I probably am more of a Republican in beliefs, but I just can't handle the rancor in that party. Okay, so interesting comment there from Heidi in Johnston. We've got a minute or so left. Chris Larimer, do you want to throw anything into the mix before we say goodbye for this hour?
No, I think Heidi's comment was interesting. It seems that we often admire candidates from afar, but once we get up close and see them in action, maybe our perceptions change. So I think it'll be interesting to see what Chris Christie does over the next few months, if he really tries to take advantage of this visibility that he has right now.
Tim Hagel, what thoughts do you want to leave us with this hour?
Sort of emphasize that thing is that I think that people like the Chris Christie's bluntness, but I've often wondered how well that's going to wear in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. Okay, maybe we'll find out. And
hope so.
As it certainly makes interesting conversation and reporting here on our airwaves. Thank you very much for joining us. Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Chris Larimer, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Gentlemen, thank you for coming into our studios today.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
She was the first woman to serve as a Chief Justice of Iowa Supreme Court, but she's perhaps best known as one of the Iowa Supreme Court justices dismissed by Iowa voters 3 years ago for her role in the decision that legalized same-sex marriage in the state. Tomorrow on this program, a conversation with Marcia Ternus, her thoughts on that ruling and on justice and judicial independence in the United States. We'll hope you'll tune in tomorrow for the program. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Technical support from Dennis Reese in Cedar Falls. Help today from Tony Daynor, the executive producer of Iowa Talk Shows, Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.